Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With each passing day, it feels like we're learning more about the effects of climate change. A recent report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released late last month, gives us insight into how quickly the world's oceans are warming and rising. Last month, we also learned that the number of birds in the United States and Canada has fallen by 29% since 1970. That's 2.9 billion fewer birds than there were 50 years ago, and climate change is thought to be playing an important role in that loss. This hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease will give us his insight into what we're learning about climate change and how it's affecting wildlife in Iowa. But first, thousands of people gathered in downtown Iowa City last Friday at noon to listen to and rally with climate activist and Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg. Iowa Public Radio reporter Kate Payne was there. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
Thank you for being here. And first of all, put this into context for us. What brought Greta Thunberg, who we've been seeing, you know, international news reports about for the last 2 years, what brought her to Iowa?
Yeah, so she wanted to rally with a local group of student activists who call themselves the Iowa City Climate Strikers. So they have been inspired by her for months and have been organizing and protesting here in Iowa City and getting some traction, actually, from city government. And she wanted to throw some support behind that. And of course, in Iowa, we're in the middle of caucus season. There's always a platform for people who want to share, you know, their views and activate Iowa caucus goers at this pivotal time.
Right, right. And these young people had written to her and asked her to come. Mm-hmm. So during this time when she's in the United States, she was willing to stop by. So tell me a little bit about the scene. There were a lot of people in downtown Iowa City.
There were a lot of people. The estimate was about 3,000 people, and the city actually shut down a number of streets for the day to hold how many people were coming. They set up a stage in the middle of a street, and it was a huge turnout. And people of all ages, too, which surprised me even a little bit how young some of the people were. There were certainly professors and college students, but also, you know, many teenagers and folks, you know, some children in arms, but also 5-year-olds, 8-year-olds who clearly knew what they were doing, knew who Greta was, and some of them brought their own signs to be there.
This event was called a climate strike, although obviously it was more of a rally, I would say. But it wasn't just Greta Thunberg speaking. Can you tell me about who else the crowd heard from?
Yeah. So the crowd heard from some of the Iowa City Climate Strikers. So this group, they initially started as junior high schoolers. Now they're in high school, young kids still, but laying out some of the plans that they had, what they've achieved in local government. And their goal now is focusing on the University of Iowa, trying to get the university to stop burning coal at its power plant. And they want that done immediately, basically. So heard from some of those strikers. The crowd also heard from Iowa City Mayor Jim Throgmorton, who recognized the strikers' pressure that had been put on him and the steps that he and the city council have taken. The crowd also heard from Iowa State Senator Joe Bolcom, whose message really was, folks out there, if you care about climate, take that to the polls at every level of government and ask your officials at every stage, what are they doing on climate?
Then, of course, came the event that everybody had come out for, Greta Thunberg. Mm-hmm. And we're going to hear a little bit of what she had to say. But first, give me a little bit of your impression. She didn't speak for very long.
No, she didn't. About 6 minutes or so. She had everyone's attention, though. I mean, she is seen as a superstar, a rock star. I mean, just something like 2 weeks before, she had been at the United Nations, you know, laying into world leaders. She has real credibility among this group of people, and they absolutely you know, they were with her every step of the way. And she really laid out messages we've heard from her before that even if world leaders don't act, people who want to see action on climate have to do this work. They have to make their own sacrifices and that they have the power to do that in their own lives.
Let's listen to what she had to say.
And we have to prepare ourselves to go on for a very long time, for years. But that will not stop us. We have reached a tipping point where enough people have had enough, and together we are unstoppable. We will not beg world leaders to care and to act. They have ignored us in the past and they will ignore us again. We will instead tell them that if they won't do it, then we will. Because the world is waking up and we are the change, and change is coming whether they like it or not.
That's just a small portion of approximately 6 minutes that she spoke. But I'm struck by her tone because, of course, when she was at the United Nations, there was a lot of anger in what she was saying. And she's clearly driven largely by frustration and anger that people are not reacting to this crisis. But her tone in front of the crowd in Iowa City was inspiring and hopeful. I mean, she really, it was a warmer kind of presentation.
Yeah, yeah. And she really wants people to be energized and to take that message home and to keep acting. And maybe hope is something that folks can lean into more than anger.
When you talked to people after she spoke, did you hear anything interesting from the crowd?
It was interesting to hear how far some of the people had come. I talked to some friends who drove an hour and a half to see her. She just drew a lot of interest. And it was interesting to hear from folks how they're going to apply climate to the presidential cycle. It's definitely something that's on people's minds. And they did feel hopeful. They're energized by her youth. That's really convincing for young people who see something of themselves in her, and older people as well who know that the next generation will be dealing with climate change in a way that they won't.
Kate Payne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Iowa Public Radio's Eastern Iowa reporter Kate Payne. And with me now is wildlife biologist and emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University, Jim Pease. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here. You know, we hear about climate change all the time in the news now. We know that it's a subject that has become politicized in many ways. But I think it's worth starting off with the fact that climate change is something that scientists have known about. We've been talking about it for my entire life, and I would guess for much of your career.
Yeah, that's for sure. In fact, I'm in full disclosure, I'm one of the 200 Iowa scientists signatories to the Iowa Climate Statement of 2019. And we you know, this isn't the first time that there's been a climate statement out, and we have known about it for quite some time. It has become more dramatic because I think not just the politics of it, but it's because it is so noticeable, finally, to people all over the world, not just those in the poles or in the tropics, which were the first ones to be very, very aware of it, but now in the temperate regions, we're seeing changes that we cannot ignore any longer. Aside from the politics of it, the science of it is very, very solid, and we have been talking about it since the 1970s.
So now that we are experiencing it on a daily basis, of course, we're understanding a great deal more about it. We're not just talking about projections or, thoughts about how this may play out in the future. We're also experiencing it. So I know you want to talk about something called phenology, which is kind of the basis of how we see how our world is changing. Tell me, first of all, what it is.
Well, phenology is sort of the study of seasonal events. And there have been folks from professional scientists all the way down to casual observers of natures that have kept records over the years. And we've talked about this on previous programs where folks will, the date of the first snow, the date of first frost, when does the first hepatica bloom in the spring, when do the lilacs bloom, when do the first robin come back? When does the first, et cetera, et cetera. All those first dates. And what we're seeing is that we can see this on a daily basis, the change that we're experiencing is rather rapid. In the past, and I say in the past, I'd say in the first, throughout the 20th century, those changes were very, very gradual. You might see a change of a day or two or even a week in some bloom times from year to year. But that happened over several decades that you'd see these minute changes. But now we're seeing very, very rapid changes. And if we look out the window this morning, my wife and I saw hummingbirds still at our feeders, and here we are almost mid-October. That is really a huge change because it used to be just a few years ago that they would be pretty much gone from central Iowa by the 1st of October. And here we are on the, what is today, the 8th. And so we're seeing that change just in the past few years. They're staying longer. They're coming back earlier. It's a very strange time. And there are dangers to that we'll talk about some more throughout the program.
All right. And why don't we pick that up after the break as well? I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's also Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. We're talking about climate change in action today, how it affects wildlife around the world and here in the state of Iowa. You're welcome to join our conversation with your observations or questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's also Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. And this hour, we're talking about climate change. We are learning more and more about climate change as we're living climate change. And we're going to talk this hour about what we know about how it affects wildlife around the world and wildlife here in Iowa. And Jim, just before the break, we were talking about phenology, that study of keeping track of when things happen every year, which for a long time may have seemed like kind of a pokey hobby to a lot of people.
Well, yeah, sort of a nerdy hobby.
Right, exactly. But now, looking at things over the long term, I mean, this is an incredibly valuable historic record because, of course, sometimes there's an early frost or a late frost. There are these outliers always.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are still saying, hey, of course, there are outliers. Weird things happen in weather in Iowa. We know that. We've always known that.
Right.
But so looking at these journals, these records, you can see patterns changing.
You certainly can see patterns changing. And in fact, if you just look at the heat events, and it's the rate of that change that has really ramped up in the last 20, 25 years especially. But prior to that, the rate of change was there, but it was slow, and there were certainly year-to-year variations. We're not looking at year-to-year. We're looking at change over time, and over time those changes have been rather dramatic. And we can see that if you look at the report that you talked about earlier from the UN on climate change, and there are some sub-reports in there that are really important to look at as well. What we see is this increase in heat in the summer, and the not just the overall rise in heat, but the rate of rise in heat. For example, in the Iowa Climate Statement. Let me just read the first couple of sentences. It says, our atmosphere and Earth's surface are warming at an unprecedented rate. Globally, the five warmest years on record were each of the last 5 years, and extreme weather disasters are increasing in frequency and severity. In the Midwest states, we've seen changes in the form of dramatic variability in rainfall, higher humidity, and warmer nights. And the statement goes on to talk about the impacts on people, on our economy, on particularly in Iowa, of course, on agriculture, especially as it relates to livestock. But my point as a wildlife biologist is that while people can, given sufficient, if you're not poor or homeless, you can, in fact, for the much of the time, escape some of these severe heat events. Wildlife cannot. They are subjected to it all the time, and that should be a canary in the coal mine, if you will, about the kinds of things that are happening. And we can look worldwide, and we can look at Iowa and see some of these changes. For example, we know now, that colonial nesting birds, particularly penguins and some other seabirds, are unable to find one parent will stay with the egg or with the young while another parent goes out to sea for a full day or sometimes a week in order to find prey and bring it back, regurgitate it for the young and raise the young. Now we're finding that many of these colonies are disappearing because the birds have to go so far to find prey, be that fish or sardines or other prey items, that they can no longer get back and the young starve. So the colonies are disappearing. There's no recruitment into the population. We look at whales. On the east coast of the United States, whale watching has been a very, very big business for particularly for the last half century. And the whales are no longer there. If we look at the Gulf of Maine, for example, it used to be this upwelling of very rich area so whales would that are long distance migrants would come into this area to feed on herring and other fish in the area, and would stay there all summer because it's very rich. They can feed their young. Their young can learn to hunt, et cetera, before they go back south. Well, now it appears that perhaps it's the melting of the glaciers that on Greenland. There's so much fresh water coming into the North Atlantic that it's changing ocean currents. And now those waters no longer support the herring and the other fish that the whales need to feed on. So the whales are no longer there. We're not sure exactly where they've gone to. But they've taken off to try to find food supplies that were up until recently were very dependable year after year. Now whales are capable of changing. They've changing their habits as climate has changed over the past thousands of years. We've seen whales still being able to adapt, but that change was not the same rate that the change is today. That change was much slower, and they were able to adapt and change their routes, their summering areas. But today, we know on the North Atlantic, it's been upset very, very quickly. So it's the rate of change that is something new, and it really threatens, I think, a lot of populations.
And you just answered this question, but I think it bears repeat. So the wildlife that we have on this earth today has evolved,
right,
has adapted over long periods of time to the conditions that we live in.
Right.
So the day length, the temperatures, and all of those things. So why can't they continue to evolve and adapt to the changing conditions?
Well, some will. Some may, I should say. I won't say they will. They certainly may. But it's a matter of the rate of that change. It's the speed of that change, because the Earth is warming so quickly now that if you look at all the graphs, you can see this sort of rapid, almost rapid upturn in increases in temperature and humidity. All those indicators are it's the rapidity of the change, not a gradual slope, but a very steep slope of that change. So with that steep slope, you can't adapt quickly enough. Some will, perhaps, but as I think Greta Thunberg talked about, it's the changes now, and we don't like to see those changes, and so we tend to hide our heads in the sand sometimes and say, oh, it's not really happening, but it is happening, and we're seeing the evidence all around us, and it's going to be very difficult for wildlife to adapt this quickly to the rapidly changing heat events in particular, but also it's the nuances of that climate change. So if you're migrating from Central or South America, and you're expending tremendous amounts of energy to get to the boreal forest, for example, or the Midwestern prairies, let's say, and your nesting is dependent upon a certain and your ability to be successful nesting is dependent upon a certain insect or a group of insects that is there at the time that you arrive when you're raising your young, so that you can give them lots of protein in order to be successful nesting. And you get there, and that period of time has passed because it warmed so quickly. You cannot be successful in raising young. And over just a few years, because you're a songbird, for example, maybe you're a bobolink on the prairies, and you are, if you cannot get there at the right time, you don't recruit into the population, the populations drop.
We're talking about climate change in action today with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And I need to ask you this question, because this is a question that people who don't want to believe in the science of climate change ask all the time. But, you know, we've been talking about these extremely hot summers and how we are seeing the temperature of the oceans rise. Of course, we have in the forecast a major October snowstorm bearing down
sure.
on the northern
yeah.
Rockies and the plains.
Right.
And we had the polar vortex. And a lot of people say, well, if it gets so cold, how can that be global warming?
Yeah.
So, Jim, I know you've answered it before, and science has,
sure.
has soundly answered that question. But answer that for us again.
Right. What happens is that you have to look at averages. And what scientists have done have taken let's take a 4-year average, and if we break that that 4-year average up over the last 50 years, we see these increases and increases in rate of increase. if you see a rapid change in that slope of increase, so those 4-year periods kind of cancel out those. The year-to-year variations, by taking 4 years, it's a much more accurate rate. And so you're looking at the average temperature over that 4-year period. So it includes all of those extremes, highs and lows, but it averages them out, and we see those 4-year averages then going up very, very rapidly. So it all you have to do is look at the data, and it's pretty obvious if you look at these slopes. That it is increasing. You bet. We've got a polar vortex, from year to year. We have a snowstorm, which is not unheard of at all, bearing down and perhaps on some of the Great Plains. those very individual variations happen. But we also had the last 5 years being the hottest 5 years on record. Every one of those of the last 5 years has been the hottest 5 years on record. So the average temperature for those 5 years is up a lot from the previous 100 years. So it's you have to look at a way to smooth out the data in order to see trends. You can't take single events as evidence.
Right, and climate and weather are not synonyms.
They're not the same. That's exactly right.
All right. We have a number of people who want to join the conversation. This comment from Kevin, he wants to know if you've been following the story about the starving grizzly bears in British Columbia due to the lack of salmon. Scientists are linking this to the rising water temperatures affecting spawning combined with the pollution from salmon farming. Locals are seeing bears show up on Vancouver Island that have never been there before as they swim several miles searching for food.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I have been following it a little bit, and I've been contrasting that with the fat bear contest in Alaska right now in Katmai, where I was fortunate to visit this summer, so we're seeing different effects in different areas, and the lack of salmon in the area is certainly a very big concern, not just for the economics of the salmon industry, and that's certainly a concern, but it's certainly a concern for bears and other wildlife. In fact, the whole ecosystem is sort of based on salmon returning each year to an area, and the nutrients that those spawning and dead salmon then provide not just to the wildlife, but the whole ecosystem. So It's one of the pieces of evidence that we certainly want to keep track of, but I think we want to look at overall what's happened to salmon fisheries up and down the whole coast, all the way from the west coast of the northwest United States all the way up to Alaska. And in fact, what's happened to salmon stocks is a combination of things. And climate is certainly one of those things that is impacting it. The warmer waters that are impacting that area doesn't allow them to properly navigate their way home.
I mentioned much earlier in the show the recent report about the fact that the number of birds in the United States and Canada has fallen by 29% since 1970. So that's 2.9 billion fewer birds than there were 50 years ago. Climate change is an element of that. But I think it's important to talk about the fact that there are other pressures as well. So you can't, look at a situation like that and just say that is because of climate change.
Right. And certainly climate change, it gets back to what I was talking about earlier. It seems to be, if you look at various groups of birds, which is what this report did, and so we need to preface it by saying it, this isn't all species. This is numbers of individuals or breeding birds. It does seem that the long-distance migrants are the ones that are certainly most impacted. Those birds that overwinter in Central and South America, some of them all the way to the southern tip of South America, and migrate to the Northern Hemisphere, some all the way to the Arctic to breed each year. So they're migrating over thousands of miles. It certainly appears that those are the ones that are the most impacted. But it includes, we see grassland birds, for example, and those that birds that would traditionally nest in Iowa prairies and the Great Plains and clear up into southern Canada. We're seeing the worst declines in grassland birds. We're talking a 53%. Half of those birds are declining. The grassland birds have declined by 53% over this time period. Specific birds are even worse. Eastern meadowlarks, for example, a terrific grassland bird that lots of people recall about hearing every morning, 75% decline. Evening grosbeaks, birds that in the 1970s, when I worked in Wisconsin, we'd have 300 of them coming to the feeders in the wintertime. Evening grosbeaks, which are a boreal forest breeder, not a grassland breeder, they've declined by 90%. So it's a real concern for certain species. And what we see then, it's not just a staggering decline of threatened and endangered species, that these declines are really across common and widespread species that those populations are diminishing. And it certainly is climate related, but there are other factors which we can talk about after the break here that are impacting not just birds, but are impacting other wildlife species as well.
All right. Jim Pease, wildlife biologist, emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management. We're talking about what we're seeing as climate change changes our planet and changes our environment, how it's affecting wildlife around the world and in Iowa. You're welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about climate change, how it's affecting wildlife around the world and here in Iowa. With me, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's also emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Diane is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to add to the conversation, and I appreciate the points that have been made, but one, some of the other factors that only exacerbate the kinds of impacts that we're finding from climate change are bee collapse, pesticides, neonicotinoids, and other pollutants. But I called because I spent the last 10 years on the board of the National Wildlife Federation, and one of the issues we've been focusing on is the Recovering Wildlife Act. And my point is, there are policy decisions that are being made at the government levels that have a huge impact negatively and positively on how things go. One thing that I think, when I give this statistics, people are just astounded, and it's a local one for North America. From the change from the 19th to the 20th century, 50% of the mammals were wildlife. When we changed from the 20th to the 21st century, 80% of the mammals in North America are either people, pets, or livestock.
Yeah.
I'm not making a judgment there, but that is such a shift. We are in peril of really eliminating wildlife from the abundance that it has been historically for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. That changes so drastically the nature of our environment, who we are, our exchange with that relationship with wildlife. And we need to be doing things and recovering wildlife and supporting the capacity for wildlife to be vibrant and to thrive. And that's one of the things I wanted to pick up in the conversation.
Yeah, excellent points. And I thank you for calling in about that, because pesticides certainly are one of those things that do exacerbate the change. You talked about the massive change in, you know, the humanization of habitats. So we have absolute habitat loss that we've documented well. We changed Iowa from a state that was 85% tall grass prairie to a state that now has 0.1% tall grass prairie. That kind of massive change and into an agricultural state is a humanizing the landscape. It makes it very, very difficult for wildlife to survive, to have sufficient habitat. At the same time, then, there are other factors that are directly responsible. Pesticides are certainly one of them, and in particular, we changed in the early 1980s, or in the late 1980s, I produced for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service a couple of brochures about the impacts of various pesticides, and we're including in that herbicides, nematicides, insecticides, all the sides that are designed to kill pests. And they're impacts on wildlife. And what we've done in the process is we've changed from pesticides that are like DDT, that were very long-lasting, very lethal, to pesticides that have to be applied more often, are somewhat less lethal. But as a result, there are the nuances of those pesticides that are much harder to measure, and we're just beginning to understand. For example, there are some pesticides that change the behavior. Their impact is not to kill the adult bird outright, but it changes their behavior so that they don't parent as well, so the young don't survive. There are pesticides that don't affect adult birds, but do breed bleed through eggshells. So happen to be herbicides that are often sprayed on roadsides that where birds are nesting, and if it can bleed through the eggshell, it kills the embryos. So the effects of it are the same in the long run, a decrease in bird abundance and stress on the birds, but they're more subtle than seeing lots of dead birds lying on the lawn, which is what Rachel Carson brought our attention to in the 1960s. There are other things, though, that are directly related to climate change that are equally as lethal. In Iowa, for example, we see, and this has come out in all kinds of reports, the most recent one by the Iowa Policy Project about flooding frequency and what we see in increase of extreme events in precipitation. So we get not only more precipitation in a year, we used to average 36 inches a year, we're now closer to 50, but we see those rains coming in increasingly in events that are extreme rain events. So we get these 5-6 inch rainstorms over a day or two, and result in flash flooding and flooding like we saw this spring that came on both coasts of Iowa and interior rivers. Why is that a concern for wildlife? Because those river and stream corridors are some of the best ribbons of habitat we have left. We have massively changed the state from a prairie state. We have 99.9% of the prairies are gone. About 70% of the woodlands are gone. The wetlands have been drained somewhere between, depending on whose estimates you take, from the 1830s, between 95 and 98% of those palustrine wetlands are gone. So that's a massive change to the landscape. So those river corridors, which were too steep to plow or even graze sometimes, are absolutely critical to wildlife. As I've talked about earlier in other programs, and I continue to speak around the state and in my rivers talks, I've had the great privilege to paddle over 2,000 miles of Iowa rivers now, and I've seen firsthand how critical those corridors are for wildlife species. When they are flooded, that habitat, wildlife succumb to flooding just as people do and suffer great damage to their homes, to their food supplies and everything. So those floods, a direct result of climate change and global warming, are really destroying a lot of critical habitat for us. In addition to higher temperatures, And there's a lot that's talked about in many reports now about increase in diseases for humans. Because of increased humidity, we see more mosquito-borne mosquito vectors of various diseases on the increase. We see it in wildlife as well. We have increasing incidence of EHD, epizootic hemorrhagic disease, in Iowa deer. It used to be a disease of the southern states. It has now moved up as far as central Iowa. This is a disease spread by midges, which were not a factor. They usually got killed off by Iowa winters, but as we've gotten milder, the midges survive and they move farther and farther north. And it's also called blue tongue. This disease is spreading among white-tailed deer in Iowa. So, you know, you get increase in diseases. We get more Lyme disease. We get more West Nile virus. They not only infect, these diseases not only impact humans, they impact other species with whom we share this state as well.
Well, Diane, thanks again for your call and for bringing that subject up. And there are so many things that we could talk about. We've got comments from Larry in Alden. He says, please don't overlook the change in farming practices here in rural Iowa, which is a whole nother show and not necessarily your area of expertise. But he said he also, in our area, north central Iowa, the marked absence of songbirds since midsummer has been conspicuous and cause for concern. Beth in Osceola says, please address the drop in insect populations. I drive a lot in the spring and summer. I've noticed that my windshield is cleaner than in seasons past. And of course, we see ups and downs with mosquito populations, with other insect populations. We talked about monarch butterflies on the program last week. And of course, that's an insect that people care about and watch. And a lot of people just don't care about insect populations. So that's a hard one to see, but it's also a hard one to get people to feel anything about.
Yeah, the reason they're so important is that that is the primary protein source for, in terms of birds, it's the insects are the primary protein source for raising young birds. Even birds that eat seeds as adults, chickadees, white-breasted nuthatches, et cetera, lots of the birds that we see at our feeders in the wintertime, in the summertime, they're grabbing insects because that is a much higher protein, a much better source of protein, more digestible, more usable, that allow those young to hatch, grow to adult size, and become healthy adults. Without those insect populations, those birds and all birds are, in fact, in real trouble. In fact, one of the main reasons that migrants go south in the wintertime is to because we have this thing called winter, which slows down ectothermic, cold-blooded, if you will, insects and kills them off. So those birds go south into central southern U.S. All the way down to South America to find food, primarily insects, and so that loss of insects due to pesticides. I just read a recent report, in fact, about how subtle and nuanced these effects can be sometimes. There was some experimentation done with a migrating sparrow called the white-crowned sparrow, and one of the neonics, neonicotinoids are a pesticide that are put on as a seed coat to keep them from being the seeds being destroyed by insects before they get out of the ground, especially by nematodes. And so they coat the seeds, and this includes corn and soybeans and wheat and a number of other small grains that are grown all across the Midwest. And if it turns out if these don't kill adult birds directly, but it impacts their ability to gain weight, to migrate, and infects them in lots of other subtle ways that we wouldn't necessarily know about, except for studies that look specifically at dosage and such things on in wild birds. And so we worry a lot about impacts on livestock and on humans, but these other things are being affected as well. And the kinds of impacts that the callers and emailers are talking about we're seeing already.
We are getting a lot of people asking this question. Ralph from Grinnell's on the line asking what an average person can do to slow down carbon emissions. Laura in Davenport says climate change and other human influence, segmented forests, reduced grasslands, pollution are causing severe decline in wildlife. What are the most impactful changes we can make as individuals to help minimize our impact? I think, you know, a lot of people care. A lot of people care.
Yeah.
But feel helpless. And I know that you don't have all the solutions for us, Jim, but
no,
throw us
no.
a rope of hope here, okay?
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I've been talking about, and I was pleased to see that that Greta mentioned it in the opening part of this program, is that we ought to be asking our officials, not just at the presidential level, although that's important too, the folks who are running for office. But go start with your local mayors, your county officials, your city officials, and encourage them, ask them what their stands are on climate change and why, and help educate them. They don't know a whole lot, oftentimes. The listeners to this program, I know a whole lot more. Sometimes I feel like I'm preaching to the choir, and know a whole lot more than a lot of elected officials do. So it's our job to educate them, ask them questions, give them the information they need to make valid decisions. One of the things I've talked about on my Rivers talk is I say, if you do nothing else, if you don't want to take a stand on a given bill or anything like that, okay. But let the officials know at the local, county, state, federal level, up and down the people that represent us at all these levels, let them know that clean water, for example, is a priority for you, and cleaning up our rivers is a priority, and making sure we still have wild places for wild people and wild things in the future. Secondly, I would say create wild habitat as much as you can on your own land. And if you don't have land to do that on, support habitat initiatives to create parks and other wild areas in your local area, be it a city, a county. Help support those professionals that are doing that work for us on the local level, county conservation boards, on the state level, the DNR. On the federal level, Fish and Wildlife Service, you can do things like buying habitat stamps. Whether or not you're a hunter, you can buy because that all that money comes directly back to states to help create habitat, all kinds of habitat on the land. Support the rapid conversion, I think, of local and state energy plants. I did note again that the goal in Iowa City is to get the University of Iowa, as Iowa State has already done, to change from coal to burning natural gas or other things, or renewables. Certainly having them convert to renewable energy, particularly wind and solar, is really important. Iowa, even though we are second in the nation in terms of the numbers of windmills we have one company who's working towards, by 2025, 100% of their energy coming from wind. 48% of Iowa's electric energy still comes from burning coal. We've got to change that, and we have to do that as citizens of the state. Reduce your own carbon footprint if you can, and look at the policies of current and future leaders. Are they conversant and supportive of climate change plans? And if so, help educate, or if not, help educate them, make it better.
Jim, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He is also Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. We had production assistance today from Stephanie Nobrega, and Nick Brinks helped us out with technical support. You never need to miss an episode of Talk of Iowa. Please subscribe to our Talk of Iowa podcast. I'm Charity Nebbie.